Track 10.
For a few minutes more, Lord Childs and Tom exchanged pleasantries. Then Childs leaned back and reached down over his ample midriff to haul the gold watch from his fob pocket. "Bless my soul, 'tis past 10, and I am expected at St. James's." He stuffed it back into his pocket. "I am sure you did not come here merely to pass the time of day."
"My lord, if I may come to the point, I am in need of employment."
"You have come to the right quarter."
Childs nodded so vehemently that his jowls wobbled like a turkey cock.
"The Seraph sails in 10 days for the Carnatic. Edward Anderson is her master. You know both him and his ship, of course. He has a berth for a third officer, which is yours for the asking."
"I had in mind something more warlike."
"Ah, Mr. Pepys is a personal friend of mine, and he knew your father. I have not the least doubt that we can find a berth for you on one of the men of war. I think a fighting frigate might suit a young man of your temperament."
"Again, sir, may I be blunt?"
Tom interrupted apologetically.
"I have at my disposal a small cutter. She is very fast and handy, an ideal craft to raid French commercial shipping in the Channel."
Childs stared at him in astonishment, and Tom hurried on before he could refuse.
"I also have a crew of fighting seamen to serve her, some of the same men who served under my father on the Seraph. All I lack is a letter of marque to attack the French."
Childs chuckled so heartily that his belly bounced on his lap like a rubber ball.
"The apple does not fall too far from the tree, does it? Like your father, you want to lead rather than follow. Of course, your warlike exploits are common knowledge. You should have Alaouf's severed head incorporated into the escutcheon of your coat of arms when you receive your own knighthood one of these fine days."
Abruptly, he stopped laughing, and Tom had a glimpse of the shrewd, calculating mind behind the benign blue eyes. Childs stood up and went to the window. He stood there staring out at the river until Tom began to fidget in his chair. Then it dawned upon him that the pause was deliberate.
He said, "My lord, I would want you to have a share of any prize I am able to take under this commission. I thought 5% might be an appropriate expression of my gratitude."
10% might be even more appropriate," Childs observed.
10% indeed," Tom agreed. "And, of course, the sooner I can sail, the sooner I will be able to make good those 10 points to you."
Childs turned to him, rubbing his hands together briskly, his expression affable.
"I'll be talking to certain personages in St. James's this very morning, gentlemen who have commissions in their gift. Call upon me again in 3 days' time, that is, Thursday, at 10 o'clock. I may have news for you then."
Those 3 days of waiting passed like a funeral procession, every minute filled with fears and misgivings. If William had taken the precaution of contacting all the powerful men he knew in London, all doors would close to Tom. Just enough time had elapsed since he had left High Weald for a messenger to dash all his plans. Even if Childs could deliver a commission, he had no ship and no crew, for he could not broach the subject with any of the men before he had the King's letter in his pocket. Luke Jarvis had already sailed on another of his nefarious trips to meet a French counterpart somewhere in mid-channel. This time he might run foul of the King's excisemen, and he might never return. The doubts gathered like circling vultures to plague not only Tom's waking hours, but his dreams. When Luke did return, would he be willing to risk his little raven in such a hazardous enterprise? He must already be a rich man, and Uberley had said that he had a wife and a brood of infants. During those 3 days, his men looked at him expectantly, but Tom could offer them nothing. He dared not even tell them what Childs had promised, lest he raise their hopes too high. On the Thursday morning he slipped out of his lodgings like a thief, without even telling Uberley where he was going. The clock in the steeple of the little church in Leadenhall Street had barely struck 10 when Lord Childs's secretary came down to the visitor's parlour to summon him. One glance at Childs's genial expression was enough to set at rest all the nightmares that had beset Tom. As soon as they had greeted each other and were seated face to face, Childs picked up the heavy parchment document from the desktop in front of him. Tom recognised the great red seal of the Chancellor of England at the foot of the single page. It was identical to the commission under which his father had sailed when the Seraph put out to sea. Childs read out the first line in a pedantic tone. "Be it known by these presents that our trusty and well-beloved subject, Thomas Courtenay," he read no further, but looked up and smiled at Tom. "By heaven's grace, you have it," Tom interjected excitedly.
"I doubt that any other captain has received his commission with such dispatch," Childs remarked. "This augurs well for our enterprise."
He emphasized the possessive plural as he set aside the commission and picked up another document.
"This is a separate contract that embodies our agreement. I have left the name of the ship blank, but we should fill that in now."
He picked up a quill and sharpened the tip before he dipped it in the inkwell and looked up at Tom expectantly. Tom took a deep breath before he committed himself. "The Raven," he said.
"The Raven,"
Childs wrote in a stylish hand, and then looked up at Tom.
"Now I will need your signature."
Tom barely glanced at the deed of joint venture before he scrawled his acceptance. Childs countersigned, then sanded the page. Still smiling affably, he crossed to a side table on which stood a platoon of crystal decanters and poured two glasses to the rim. He handed one to Tom and saluted him with the other.
"Perdition to Louis the 14th, and a black pox on the French."
Aberley haggled for a ferryman to row them upriver to where Luke Jarvis had his moorings, on a small island with the unlikely name of Eel Pie. From a cable's length they saw that the Raven had returned from her most recent jaunt and was tied up at the wooden jetty. As they closed the distance, Luke came out of the cottage, set among a stand of willow trees, and sauntered out onto the jetty to meet them, leaving a thin stream of blue pipe smoke in the air behind him. Tom sprang ashore, while Aberley paid the ferryman his sixpence.
"A profitable voyage, Master Luke?" he asked. "The excisemen gave us a run off Sheerness. I had to toss 3 hogsheads of brandy overboard before we could give them the slip. All my profits for the last 6 months gone down to Davy Jones."
He rubbed the scar on his cheek and looked mournful.
"I think I'm getting too old for the game, Mr. Courtenay."
"Perhaps I can interest you in something less taxing on your nerves," Tom suggested.
Luke perked up noticeably.
"I thought you had something in mind." "Ah, you remind me of your father. He was ever the man with an eye to the main chance."
At that moment a woman appeared in the doorway of the cottage. Her apron was grimy from the cooking fire, and she carried a naked infant with a dirty bottom on her hip. The child clung with both hands to the soft white breast that dangled limp as a spaniel's ear from the opening of her blouse.
"Luke Jarvis, don't you dare go off carousing with your riff-raff friends and leave me here with no food in the house and 6 hungry babes to feed," she screeched,
her hair dangling lankly down her face. Luke winked at Tom.
"My little angel, marriage is a fine and noble state. Too good for the likes of me, I oft-times think."
The woman shrieked.
"It's time you look for honest work instead of sneaking away in the night and coming home with some cock-and-bull story about losing your coin, when I know full well you've been lying at anchor with some poxy slut in Pussy Bay."
"Do you have honest work for me, Mr. Courtenay? Any work that takes me well out of earshot of my good wife?"
"That is what I came to talk to you about," Tom grinned with relief. 3 nights later, the Raven crept inshore of the French coast with a leadsman in the bows.
"By the mark, 5,
he called the depth softly, then opened the shutter of the lantern a crack to examine the tallow on the end of the lead to see what it had picked up from the sea bottom.
"Sand and shell,"
he reported, little louder than a whisper. "Huitre Bank," Luke nodded in the dark, his position confirmed.
"That's Calais, over to starboard. Au Fleur, beyond a headland."
His pronunciation of the difficult names was fluent. Tom knew from Aberley that he spoke the language like a native.
"The beach shoals in very gently here, and with this breath of wind from the east we'll be able to wade ashore without difficulty," he told Tom. "Be ready to drop over when I give the word."
Tom had decided that only he and Luke would go ashore to scout the anchorage of Calais. Luke knew the ground and might be able to talk them out of any trouble they met. He'd been tempted to take Aberley with them, but the smallest party was prudent, and Aberley's black face would be hard to pass off if they were challenged by a French patrol.
"By the mark, two," came the soft call from the bows. "Ready now," Luke murmured, and handed the wheel to his mate.
He and Tom picked up their leather sacks and moved up to the bows. Both men were dressed in rough fishermen's clothes with clogs on their feet and leather jerkins over wool petticoats. Their heads were covered with wool caps. At that moment, they felt the Raven take the bottom, a soft bump on the sandy beach.
"Vast heaven,"
Luke whispered to the men on the long sweeps, and they rested on the oars. He went over the side first, and the water came to his armpits. Tom handed down the two sacks to him, then followed him over. The water was cold enough to take his breath away.
"Heave away,"
the mate called quietly to the oarsman, and the Raven backed slowly off the sand. Luke had chosen the incoming tide to make certain they would not be stranded. Within a dozen strokes, the little boat had disappeared into the night, and Tom shivered again, not only from the cold. It was an eerie feeling to be alone on an enemy shore, not knowing what waited for them on the beach. The water shallowed quickly, and they came out on the hard, wet sand and crouched there, listening. There was only the flop and hiss of the low surf, so they jumped up and hurried into the dunes. They rested there for a few minutes to listen again and catch their breath, then moved quickly through the dunes and low scrub towards the headland. Half a mile further along, they almost ran into the wreckage of an ancient shipwreck stranded above the high water mark.
It's the old Bonheur, a Breton coaster, Luke told Tom, a good landmark for our return.
He dropped on his knees and scratched a hole in the sand under the bone-white ribs of the hull. There he dropped one of the leather sacks into it and covered it with the loose sand.
We'll find it here when we need it.
They went on faster now, and climbed the headland. On the crest they moved slower, using the low salt scrub as cover, trying to keep out of sight as they searched for a hiding place. They found one in the ruins of a stone-built structure that Luke had said had been a French army blockhouse during the Dutch Wars. It had been sited to give an unrestricted view over the approaches and the main anchorage. They scouted the area around the fort to make certain that it was deserted and that there were no signs of recent occupation before they settled in. From his sack, Luke brought out a pair of pistols for each of them. They loaded them with fresh powder, checked the priming, and laid them ready to hand. Then they waited for the dawn. Eventually, the eastern horizon turned lemon and rosebud pink and cast a lovely warm glow over the scene below them. Even at this hour there was a swarm of activity around the fleet of the French men-of-war that lay at anchor in the harbour. Through the lens of his telescope, Tom counted 15 three-deckers, with 80 guns apiece, and a huge gathering of lesser ships. Many did not have their yards crossed, and workmen swarmed over their decks. The activity on shore was also brisk, and as soon as the sun rose out of the morning haze, they saw companies of troops marching into the town along the road from Paris. The sunlight glittered on the bayonets of their sloped muskets, and the feathers and ribbons in their tricorn hats bobbed and fluttered with each pace. A train of wagons was following, rumbling over the rutted roadway. A little later, a squadron of cavalry in gold frock jackets and blue capes with polished black high boots trotted out from the town. For a heart-stopping moment, Tom thought they were heading straight up the slope towards their hiding place. He let out his breath in a sigh of relief as they turned away at the crossroads outside the town and rode southwards along the road, flanked on both sides with lines of poplar trees. Their dust cloud disappeared in the direction of Honfleur. As the sun climbed higher, burning off the low cloud, and the light strengthened, Tom could concentrate his telescope on a search of the harbour. There were dozens of smaller craft among the warships. Some were lighters and barges, taking out stores and men to the larger vessels. A barge flying warning flags rowed slowly to one of the three-deckers, riding low in the water under the high-piled kegs of black powder. Other craft were tied up at the wharf or anchored higgledy-piggledy about the bay. Many were rigged fore and aft with single mast and bowsprit. In smaller vessels, this new arrangement of sails had some advantages over the more traditional square-rigged ships and was becoming increasingly popular in all modern navies. They could be handled by fewer men and were faster on the wind. They were often employed as scouts and auxiliaries to the main battle fleet. An intermittent stream of these vessels and other small ships was coming and going in and out of the bay, all keeping well inshore to avoid the attentions of the Royal Navy. The English fleet was blockading the main channel ports, waiting for the French to sally forth in any strength. Out in mid-channel, Tom had caught an occasional glimpse of the distant sails of the English fleet. The Raven was also out there somewhere, waiting for nightfall, before coming into the beach again and picking them up out of the shallows. Tom turned his attention from the shipping out in the channel and avidly studied the smaller French vessels in the anchorage. Most were much larger than the little Raven, and many were armed with small cannon. He picked out a dozen that might serve his purpose well, but then was forced to discard one after the other as he discovered their defects. Some were in a poor state of repair or too lightly armed, others were coasters and not suited to long voyages and heavy seas. Still others did not have the burden to carry the cargo and men he required. In the middle of the day, Tom and Luke lay on their bellies in the warm sand and ate a meal of bread, ham, and hard-boiled eggs that Luke produced from his sack, and they passed between them the flask of beer. Tom tried not to become despondent, but there seemed little here for them. As the sun dipped towards the horizon, he was left with a choice of two out of the dozens of vessels he had scrutinized. Then one of these hoisted her mainsail and tacked out to sea, by default leaving him with no option but a nondescript old drab of a cutter, which had seen better days and fairer times. "She'll have to do," he decided unhappily, and they gathered up their pistols and equipment, ready to retreat down to the beach as soon as it was dark. Suddenly Tom seized Luke's arm and pointed back towards the north. "There she is," he exulted. "That's her." Greyhound lean and swift, a sloop came flying round the headland, then tacked neatly into the fairway and shot into the harbour. "Look at her. She's heavily laden. You can see that from her waterline. But still she could turn 15 knots on a virgin's fart," Luke whispered in awe of her beauty. She was flush-decked, no poop or forecastle. Her single mast was elegantly raked and proportioned to the length of her hull. Tom estimated that she was 50 foot overall. 10 guns, Tom counted through his lens. Enough to frighten off any Arab dhow. She flew a gaff mainsail with a boom, from her square yard a large topsail, and from her bowsprit two jibs. In the fading light she had a ghostly ethereal appearance, a thing of wind and wave spume and sea fret. "I love her already, and I don't even know her name." "Oh, we'll choose a new name for her," Tom promised him. The sloop rounded up to the hard. Down came her canvas and was whisked away like a wizard's trick. They strained their eyes to watch her tie up. Tom counted her crew and made it 9, but he guessed she could accommodate 30 fighting seamen on a long voyage, although they might have to alter her lower deck to take so many. "Mark her well, Luke," Tom said, without taking the telescope from his eye. "You must find her again in the dark." "She is burned into my eye," Luke assured him. In the last of the light they saw 6 men leave the ship and make their way down the wharf to where the lanterns in the windows of the taverns were being lit. "You can smell their thirst from here. They'll not be back before dawn," Tom whispered. "That leaves only 3 men aboard." As the last of the light faded, they hurried back down the dunes to the beach. Luke dug out the other sack from under the wreck and lit the lantern it contained with flint and steel. He pointed it out towards the sea and lifted the shutter, flashing 3 times. He waited a while, then flashed again. On the 4th attempt, his signal was answered with 3 short flashes out on the dark sea. They waded out until the low surf was breaking into their faces, and when they heard the creak of oars out in the night, Luke whistled sharply. Minutes later, the Raven loomed over them. They reached up and pulled themselves on board. Still dripping seawater, Luke took the helm and they backed off from the shelving beach. As soon as he had sufficient water under her, he set the mainsail and jib. Tom stripped naked and dried his body on the rough cloth Aberley handed him, then pulled on dry clothes. A league offshore, Luke hove the Raven to, and they squatted in a circle around a shaded lantern on the open deck. "We have found a ship," Tom told his men. Their faces were wolfish in the lantern light. "But it's not going to be light winds and fair weather to take her out under the noses of the French." He did not want them to become overconfident. "We will wait until the middle watch, when they are tucked into their hammocks. Master Luke will take us into the harbour and lay us alongside the sloop. If we're challenged, Luke will answer for us. The rest of you, hold your tongues." He frowned at them to impress on them the need for silence. "As we come alongside, I will give the word and lead the boarding party. Aberley and Alf Wilson will help me clear the deck of the enemy. Most are ashore and look to be there all night. We should have no more than three men to deal with. No pistols, only clubs and fists. Use your blades only as a last resort. Silence is our main concern, and a man with steel in his belly will squeal like a sow giving birth. Fred will throw off the headlines and Reggie the stern. Cut and run, lads, so have your jackknives handy." Then Tom spoke to each man in turn, making him repeat his orders so that there would be no confusion in the dark. With Luke and his crew of three, there were 15 of them. The rest were old salts from the Seraph, whom Alf and Aberley had been able to gather at such short notice. More than enough to do the job. "The wind is easterly, and Luke reckons it will strengthen before midnight. I didn't see them put gaskets on the main, so it should come free at a pull on the halyard." Tom looked at Ned Tyler, his gnarled features highlighted by the yellow glow of the lantern. "Mr. Tyler, you will go to the helm. Don't get into the fighting. Luke will lead us out in the Raven. He will show a shaded light over his stern." When every man knew what Tom wanted of him, Tom checked their weapons and made sure everyone had a club and knife. Tom would be the only man to carry a long blade. He strapped the Neptune sword around his waist. He had made certain before they sailed that each of them was dressed in dark-coloured clothing, and now he passed the lantern round the circle, and they smeared the soot from the chimney on their faces and hands. There were the usual jokes about Aberley not needing this addition to his natural pigmentation, and then they settled down below the gunwales, wrapped in their sea cloaks, to eat some bread and cold meat before trying to snatch a few hours' sleep. At the end of the first watch, Luke started to ease the Raven closer inshore. With the offshore breeze, they could hear the sounds from the land quite clearly, and a church clock in the town struck 12 so loudly that they could count each stroke. Tom passed the word, and they shook the sleepers awake. There were few of them. Most were already tense and nervous. They had to beat into the harbour against the breeze, but this was a price Tom was pleased to pay in exchange for a straight run out. Soon they were among the French fleet, passing so close to one tall three-decker that they could hear the anchor watch on the main deck talking drowsily. No one challenged them, and Luke threaded the Raven quietly towards the stone wharf where they had last seen the sloop. Tom crouched in the bows, peering ahead for the first glimpse of the French vessel. There was always a chance that she had sailed or moved away from the wharf, but Tom prayed that most of her crew were still swilling ale in the taverns and that her captain intended waiting until morning to offload her cargo. Slowly the Raven closed with the dark wharf, weaving her way between two anchored ships. Tom strained his eyes, cupping his hands to cut out reflected light from the lamps of the houses along the waterfront. Now he could hear laughter and singing from the alehouses, but the rest of the fleet was silent, showing only their riding lamps at the mastheads. "She is gone!" Tom's spirits plummeted as they drew within half a pistol shot of where he had last seen the sloop, and there was still no sight of her. He cursed himself for not having taken the precaution of picking out a secondary target for just such an eventuality. He was about to call to Luke at the helm for him to sheer off, when his heart leapt and thudded against his ribcage. He had seen her bare mainmast outlined against the dull glow of lamplight from the town, and he realized that with the low tide, the sloop's hull had dropped below the level of the wharf, so that it did not show up against the stonework.
Still there, waiting for us.
He glanced back to make sure his men were ready. They were crouched, like him, below the gunwales. With blackened faces, they looked like untidily stacked cargo along the deck. Only Luke stood tall at the wheel. Now he spun it to full lock, and his mate, the halyard, without waiting for an order, let the mainsail come down with a soft rush. The Raven slowed and drifted in until she touched the side of the moored French vessel. The deck of the sloop was 6 feet higher than the Raven's, and Tom steadied himself to leap up onto her. At the jolt of the two hulls coming together, a sleepy French voice exclaimed,
"Oh, nom de Dieu!" "I have a message for Marcel," Luke answered in the same language. "There is no Marcel here," the Frenchman protested irritably. "You are spoiling my paintwork with your dungboat." "I have the 50 francs that Jacques owes him," Luke insisted. "I will send one of my crew to bring it to you."
The mention of such a large sum stilled any further protest, and the Frenchman's tone became cunning and ingratiating.
"Très bien. Give it to me. I will see that Marcel gets it."
Tom sprang over the Raven's side and hauled himself lithely up onto the sloop's deck. The Frenchman was leaning over the rail, a woolen cap on his head and a clay pipe clenched between his teeth. He straightened and removed the pipe from his mouth.
"Give it to me."
As he came across the deck with hand outstretched, Tom saw he had a magnificent pair of twirling moustaches. "Certainly," he said, and tapped the man above the left ear with a controlled swing of the club. Without a sound, he went down in a heap. In the next second, Abeli came over the side and landed like a panther on silent bare feet. Tom saw that one of the hatches in the bows was open, and that faint lamplight was reflected from below. He dropped down the companionway with Abeli close behind him. A lantern swung from gimbals in the deck overhead, and by its light, Tom saw that three hammocks were slung across the far end of the cabin. He realized that he had miscounted the numbers of the French crew. As he crossed the cabin, a man sat bolt upright suddenly in the nearest hammock.
"Qu'est-ce là?" he asked.
By way of reply, Tom hit him with a full swing. The man fell back, but another shouted with alarm in the next hammock. Abeli swung it upside down and dumped him on the deck. Before he could shout again, Tom swung his club and he collapsed. A third Frenchman leapt from the last hammock and tried to run for the companionway, but Tom seized his bare ankle and hauled him back. Abeli bunched one huge fist, slammed it into the side of the man's head, and he went down.
"Any more?" Tom looked around swiftly. "That is the last."
Abeli raced up the ladder, and Tom followed him up onto the deck. Fred and Reggie had cut the mooring ropes, and the sloop was already drifting away from the wharf. The Frenchman's shout in the cabin must have been muffled and had not raised the alarm. The harbour seemed as quiet and somnolent as before.
"Ned!"
Tom whispered, and the reply came instantly from the stern.
"Aye, Captain!"
Even in the heat of that moment it gave Tom a thrill to hear the term of address.
He had a ship, and he was a captain once more. "Well done! Where is the Raven?"
"Dead ahead. She's already under sail."
There was some delay among the men at the halyards of the sloop's mainmast. In the dark and on a strange foreign ship, they were having difficulty sorting out the lines. The French used a different system of rigging. Tom ran to them, and they set about the unravelling. But the sloop was gathering sternway and drifting down rapidly on one of the anchored ships. Tom saw that they would crash into it with sufficient force to do damage. A Frenchman aboard the other ship shouted,
"Have a care, you stupid oafs! You are going to ram us!"
"Stand by to fend off,"
one of Tom's crew said in English. There was an immediate shout from the other vessel.
"Merde! Ils sont anglais!"
Tom snatched the main halyard out of the tangle of lines.
"Smartly now! Heave!"
The mainsail soared up the mast. The sloop checked her sideways drift and picked up the breeze. She began to sail, but she still had way on her, and struck the anchored ship, and dragged lightly along her side. By now other voices were shouting,
"English! The English are attacking!"
A sentry on the wharf, rudely waked from his sleep, fired his musket, and immediately there was uproar through the entire anchorage. But Ned had the sloop sailing, picking up speed sweetly. When Tom looked ahead, he saw the Raven, her stern lantern glimmering, heading down the fairway towards the open sea.
"Jib sheets!"
Tom snapped, and led a rush of bare feet down the deck towards the bows. They were getting the hang of her sails now, and the jibs went up with only scant delay. Immediately the sloop heeled and leapt forward, the water rustled under her forefoot, and they began to overhaul the Raven. But the French fleet was coming awake. There were shouts from ship to ship, and on some battle lanterns were lit and running up the masts. Inspired by the mounting turmoil, Tom ran to one of the sloop's guns. It was a toy compared to the huge armaments of the ships of the line anchored all around them. He could only hope that it was loaded.
"Help me!"
he called to Ubberly. And between them they swung open the lid of the gun port and ran out the cannon. Tom looked up and saw that they were passing half a pistol shot from one of the ships of the line, a mountainous 74 that blotted out half the night sky above them. He did not even have to aim the little cannon, but merely fired as she lay. The lock sparked, but there was a long moment as the weapon hung fire. Then, abruptly, it bellowed and leapt back against its tackle. Tom heard the ball strike into the heavy planking of the warship with a crash. Wild yells of anger pursued them, but the sloop was running on. She was so low against the water that she was swiftly lost in the dark. Somewhere further down the line another gun fired, and Tom saw from the long flash of flame that it was aimed nowhere near them. He never knew where the shot struck. There were more shouts, and then a stuttering of cannon fire built up into a deafening fusillade as the big ships fired at the imaginary English fleet attacking them. Powder smoke drifted in a dense fog over the two smaller ships. They were almost obscured from each other, and Tom had to stare hard into the smoke to pick out the faint light of the Raven's guiding lantern. Swiftly the shouting and gunfire fell behind them, and they sailed out of the smoke into a sweet, clear night. He heard faint voices on the breeze, English voices, and he realized that the tiny crew of the Raven were cheering them. His own crew paused at their work with the sheets and cheered back. It was unwise to give any French pursuit a lead. But Tom did not try to stop them. He saw Abouli's teeth gleaming white in the darkness, and he grinned back. "Where are the Frenchmen?" he demanded, and the three bedraggled figures were dragged up from the cabin to join their captain in the stern. "There's a skiff in the bows," Tom said. "We'll heave to and put them into it. Send them home with our best compliments." They bundled the four men into the little boat and cast them off. When he realized what was happening, the French captain stood in the bows of the tiny craft, his moustaches bristling with fury, shaking both fists at them, and saw them off with a string of vituperation.
"Your mother was a cow, and she slipped you from the wrong hole, you lumps of wet turd. I piss in your mother's milk. I stamp on your father's testicles."
"I speak English," Luke shouted back. "The beauty of your poetry is wasted on the night air."
And the captain's outrage faded swiftly into the darkness behind him. Abberly helped Tom trim the mainsail, and when it was drawing tight and hard, he said,
"She is yours now, Klebe. What will you call her?"
"What did the French christen her?"
Alf Wilson leaned far out over the stern and craned down to read the name on her transom in the light of the stern lamp.
"Hirondelle. What does that mean?"
"The Swallow,"
Luke translated.
"It's a good name," they all agreed at once. "God knows she flies like a bird."
"But not in that godforsaken language," Tom demurred. "In sweet mother English." "The Swallow. We will drink her health when we tie up in the river." And they gave her a cheer.
When the sun came up, they were off Sheerness. And although she had all sails set, the Raven was far astern, unable to keep up with the Swallow. The sloop was on a broad reach, ripping white bursts of spray off the tops of the pewter grey waves as she tore through them.
"She loves to run free," Ned rejoiced, his face creased into 100 wrinkles of delight. "You would have to hang a drogue over her stern to hold her back."
In the sparkling morning light she was as pretty as a maiden in her wedding dress, her canvas so new and bright that it gleamed like mother of pearl. Her paintwork was so fresh Tom could whiff the turpentine, and her decks had been holystoned until they were white as a snowfield. Tom turned his thoughts to the cargo they were carrying in the Swallow's hold. He beckoned to Abberley and sent him to investigate. They lifted the hatches, and Abberley and Alf Wilson went down with lighted lanterns into the dark holds. Half an hour later, they emerged again, looking delighted with their discovery. "She's stuffed the gills with canvas cloth, the finest quality, enough to clothe a squadron of ships of the line." Tom's face lit as happily. He knew what prices that commodity would fetch in the company's auction rooms. "The sinews of war," he declared. "Good as gold." They offloaded the cargo of canvas at the company's wharf. Then Tom sent a note to Lord Childs and took the Swallow upriver to Luke's mooring at Eel Pie Island. He stayed long enough with his men to get them started on the work of altering the sloop's tween decks to accommodate a larger crew and installing tiny cabins for the master and the three officers. These would be not much larger than cubbyholes, comprising a bunk, a sea chest, a lid of which could be used as a writing desk or chart table, and not much else. The headroom under the deck beams would force the occupant to bend almost double when entering and leaving. Tom made plans to lay out the forecastle so that it would accommodate 20 men. He moderated his original estimate of the number of men he would need to sail and fight the ship in an emergency, and still carry sufficient cargo of stores for a 3-year cruise and trade goods to ensure a profit at the end of that time. As it was, the conditions in the crew's quarters would be crowded even in fine weather, when most of the men would sleep on the open deck, but in foul weather, when they were all forced below, it would become too cramped even for hardened old sea salts like the men Alf and Abberley had recruited. Once the new interior had been planned and the carpenters put to work, Tom and Abberley hired a ferryboat to take them downriver. When they called at Leadenhall Street, the secretary told them that Lord Childs was at the House of Lords and would be there all day. However, he had received Tom's note and was expecting Tom to call. His secretary handed Tom a note he had left. "My dear Thomas, I was not expecting to receive word of your successes at such an early date. The cargo from your prize has already been sold to the Admiralty, and we have received a goodly price for the entire amount. I need to discuss this with you. Please attend me at the Lord's, where a steward will bring a message to me in the house. Your servant, N.C. Tom and Abberley made their way down the embankment to where the enormous edifice of government, the Palace of Westminster, stood on the bank of the Thames. The steward accepted the letter that Tom proffered at the visitor's door of the House of Lords, and he waited for a remarkably short time before Lord Childs, looking flustered and distraught, came puffing down the stairs and seized Tom's arm. Without any preamble, he blurted out, "Your brother William is in the house. I left him not 10 minutes hence. You should have given me warning of the state of affairs that exists between you," he shouted for his carriage. "I think you should be warned that he is intent on retribution for the injuries you have done him." "'Tis Billy who was to blame," Tom started angrily. But Childs bundled him in through the door of the carriage as it drew up at the entrance. "Bombay House," he ordered the driver. "As fast as you like." Then he tumbled onto the seat beside Tom. "Your bosun can ride up with the footman," he said, and Tom shouted to Abberley to climb on the footplate. The carriage started off with a jerk, and Childs lifted his wig to mop his pate. "Your brother is a major shareholder in the company, not a man to trifle with. He must not see us together. For the sake of good order, I have told him that I have had no dealings with you." "He cannot do anything to me," Tom said, with more certainty than he felt. He had to cling to the side-strap of the lurching carriage and raise his voice above the clatter of hoofs and the thunder of the steel-shod wheels over the cobbles. "I think you underestimate the strength of your brother's animosity, Courtney," said Childs. And he stuffed the wig back on his shaven head. "No matter what the right and wrong of the situation, if a person in my position, dare I say a man of certain influence, does not wish to fall foul of him, then how much more should you, a disinherited younger son, keep out of the path of his vengeance?" Childs was silent a little while, then said reflectively, "I have seldom heard such malice, such pure venom, from any other human being." They were silent for the rest of the drive to Bombay House. However, when they drove in through the gates, Childs leaned out of the window and called to the driver.
"Take us to the stables, not the main door."
In the stable yard, he led Tom to a small rear door into the mansion.
"I know your brother has spies out looking for you. It is best that he does not learn of our meeting today."
Tom hurried after Childs along what seemed an endless series of passages and stairways until he found himself in a small cabinet with tapestry-hung walls and a large ormolu and gilt escritoire in the centre of the floor. Childs waved him to a chair beside his own, then scrabbled through the documents that covered the top of the desk and picked out one.
"Here is the bill of sale of the cargo of canvas from the French sloop Hirondelle to the Admiralty."
He passed it to Tom.
"You will see that I have deducted the usual handling fee from the total."
20%? Tom burst out in amazement.
"It is customary," Childs said briskly. "If you care to reread our agreement, you will see it is covered in Clause 15.
Tom made a gesture of resignation.
"What about the Hirondelle herself? Will you take your 20% on her value also?"
They began to bargain, and Tom soon discovered why Nicholas Childs had risen so high in the world of trade and commerce. He had the sinking feeling that he was matched against a swordsman far out of his class. At one point, Childs excused himself and left Tom alone for so long that he began to fidget, and finally jumped up from the chair to pace the room impatiently. Meanwhile, in the room next door, Childs dashed off a long message on a sheet of parchment.
While he sanded and folded it, he told his secretary quietly, "Send Barnes to me."
When the coachman stood before him, Childs said, "Barnes, this message is for Lord Courtney at the House of Lords. You must see it safely into his hands. It is a matter of life and death."
"Very good, my lord.
When you return, I shall want you to take my guest and his servant to the river landing at the Tower of London. However, you are not to proceed there immediately.
This is what you are to do."
Childs gave the driver detailed instructions, and when he had finished, asked, "Do you understand, Barnes?"
"Perfectly, my lord."
Childs bustled back into the cabinet where Tom waited and made his apologies.
Forgive me, but there were demanding matters to which I had to attend with dispatch."
He patted Tom's arm genially.
"Now back to business."
By the middle of that afternoon, Tom found that he had the deeds of ownership to the Hirondelle, but that he would receive no monies from the sale of the cargo. In addition, Nicholas Childs had wanted to retain a 25% interest in any future profits that Tom accrued under the commission Childs had procured for him. Tom knew that he was a chicken to Childs's fox, but he held out stubbornly. The one thing Tom had in his favour was that Childs had not seen the Swallow, and the description he had been given did not do the sloop justice, so did not excite his avarice. Childs had no employment for such a tiny craft, and Tom sensed that he was willing to let her go. He stood his ground, and in the end, Childs dropped his exorbitant demands and agreed to deliver the deeds of the sloop to Tom, clear of any impediment to the title. In exchange, Childs retained the proceeds of the cargo. Childs looked well pleased with his bargain. As well he should, Tom thought grimly. He wondered how he was going to be able to explain to the men who had fought to seize the Hirondelle in Calais Roads that they would not be seeing any monetary rewards for their efforts.
"It would be a wise man, Courtney, to leave England as soon as you can hoist sail, and to stay at the ends of the ocean as long as your brother's memory lasts."
Childs smiled magnanimously.
"I'm offering you the means for you to escape from a dangerous situation with your hide intact."
At that juncture there was a soft tap on the door of the cabinet, and the secretary stepped in at Childs's command.
"The matter has been attended to, my lord. Barnes has returned and is waiting to convey your guests."
"Very good," Childs nodded.
"Excellent indeed."
He rose at once to his feet and smiled at Tom.
"I think that concludes our business, Courtney. I understand you wish to take a ferry boat from the Tower."
In friendly fashion, he saw Tom to the front door of the mansion, where Barnes waited with the carriage. As they shook hands, Childs asked guilelessly,
"Where will you take your new ship, and when will you sail?"
Tom knew that the question was barbed, and he sidestepped the thrust.
I have only this minute become her new owner, he laughed. I have not yet had time to consider that question.
Giles was staring into his eyes, watching for any attempt to prevaricate, and Tom was forced to go on.
I think the ports of southern France on the Mediterranean would be my best area of endeavour, or perhaps the French territory of Louisiana on the Gulf of Mexico. I might take the Swallow, for that is her new name, across the Atlantic.
Giles grunted, not entirely convinced.
I do most sincerely hope, Courtney, that you do not harbour any thought of rounding the Cape of Good Hope and searching for your lost brother in the ocean of the Indies.
Sweet Jesus, no, sir, Tom laughed again. I am not fool enough to try the Cape of Storms in a paper hat like the Swallow.
All the territories beyond the Cape have been granted by royal charter to the Honourable Company. Any interloper will be dealt with in the harshest manner the law allows.
It was clear from the steely gleam in his blue eyes that he would not be bound by the law in his retribution. There was an old maritime saying that there is no law beyond the line, which meant that civilized law did not always apply at the ends of the ocean. Childs gripped his arm hard to make the point unmistakably.
In fact, I think you would be wise to fear me more than your brother if you were rash enough to sail across my bows. I assure you, my lord, that I look upon you as my good friend, and that I would do nothing to change that, Tom told him earnestly.
Then we have understood each other.
Giles masked his hard expression with a smile as earnest as Tom's, and they shook hands.
It matters not a jot, Giles told himself smugly. I think this lad's final destination is in the hands of his elder brother now.
Aloud, he said, well, go with God, and added silently, or the devil, and waved a pudgy white hand.
Tom leapt lightly into the carriage and beckoned Utterly to take the seat beside him. Childs stepped back and nodded at the coachman, who returned a significant look, then touched the brim of his hat with the whip. He shook up the reins, and the carriage rolled away.
Tom and Utterly were so deep in conversation that neither noticed the route the driver followed. The narrow streets were so homogeneous that there were no landmarks for them to orientate themselves. As the carriage lurched along, Tom related to Utterly all the details of the meeting with Childs. At the end, Utterly said,
"It is not as bad a bargain as you think, Klebby. You have the Swallow and a crew to sail her."
"I have to pay Luke Jarvis and the men who came with us to Calais out of my own purse," Tom demurred. "They're expecting a share of the cargo."
"Offer them a share and a berth in this next voyage. It will make them more eager to serve."
"I have but £600 left of my prize money from the Seraph to fit out the Swallow and provision her."
"No," said Utterly. "You have £1,200.
"What nonsense is this, Utterly?" Tom turned in the seat to stare at him.
"I have the prize money I earned with your father during all the years we sailed together. I will add it to yours."
Utterly shrugged.
"I have no other use for it."
"You will be my full partner. I will sign a deed." Tom made no effort to hide his delight.
"If I cannot trust you by now," Utterly almost smiled, "what good will a piece of paper do me? It is only money, Klebe."
"With £1,200 we can refit and provision the Swallow and fill her holds with trade goods. You will not regret this, my old friend, I swear it to you."
"I regret few things in my life," Utterly said impassively, "and when we find Dorian I will have no regrets at all. Now, if you have done chattering, I will sleep a little."
He leaned back in the seat and closed his eyes. Tom studied his face surreptitiously, musing on the simple philosophy and inner strength that made Utterly a man content and complete in himself.
"He is without vice," Tom thought, "not driven by the need to command or to amass wealth, possessed of a strong sense of loyalty and honour, a stoic and a man of deep natural wisdom, a man at peace with himself, able to enjoy all the gifts he has been given by his strange forest gods, and to endure without complaint all the ills and hardships the world can hurl against him." He studied the polished black cranium on which grew not a single hair, neither black nor silver, to betray his age. Then he looked closer at the face. The elaborate patterns of the tattoo that covered it hid any ravages that time might have left upon it. I wonder how old he truly is. He seemed as ageless as a cliff of black obsidian. Although he must have been a great deal older than Tom's father, none of his faculties or strength had been impaired by the passing of the years. "He is all I have left now," Tom thought, and found himself in awe at the depth of his respect and affection for the big man. "He is my father and my counsellor. More than that, he is my friend." Without opening his eyes, Abberley spoke suddenly, startling Tom from his reverie. "This is not the way to the river."
"How do you know that?" Tom glanced out of the window and saw only dark buildings that seemed derelict in the eerie fading light. The narrow streets were deserted except for a few stray, heavily cloaked figures hurrying he knew not where, or standing sinister and still in dark doorways, their faces hidden so he could not tell if they were man or woman.
"How do you know?" he repeated.
"We have been travelling away from the river," Abberley said. "Long ago we should have reached the landing at the tower, if that is where he is taking us."
Tom did not doubt Abberley's sense of time and direction. It was infallible. He leaned out of the window and hailed the driver on the box.
"Where are you taking us, fellow?"
"Where his lordship ordered, to Spitalfields Market."
"No, you idiot," Tom shouted. "We want to go to the Tower of London."
"I must have heard wrong. I'm sure his lordship ordered." "A pox on what his lordship said. Take us where I tell you. We need a ferry boat to take us upriver."
Grumbling loudly, the driver turned the carriage, backing and filling in the narrow lane, with the footman tugging at the bridle of the lead horse to force him to obey.
"We'll not get there till after 6 o'clock, the driver warned Tom. "You'll find no ferry boat at that hour."
"We'll take our chance on that," Tom snarled back at him. "Do as you are told, man."
Sullenly, the driver whipped up the horses into a trot, and they lurched and swayed through the ruts and puddles back the way they had come. Gradually, they were enveloped in a soft, creeping fog that heralded the approach of evening. The buildings they passed now were wreathed in smoking grey tendrils, and even the sounds of the carriage wheels and the horses' hoofs were deadened by the thick white blanket. It was colder suddenly. Tom shivered and drew his cloak closer around his shoulders.
"Is your sword loose in its scabbard, Cleppe?" Abberley asked.
Tom looked at him in alarm.
"Why do you ask?"
But he laid his hand upon the blue sapphire in the hilt and held the scabbard tight between his knees.
"You may have need of it," Abberley grunted. "I smell treachery. The fat old man sent us out of our way for good reason."
"It was a mistake by the driver," Tom said. But Abberley laughed softly.
"It was no mistake, Cleppe."
His eyes were open now, and he eased his own sword in its scabbard, drawing the blade an inch, then reseating it with a soft scraping sound. After another long silence, he spoke again.
"We are near the river now."
Tom opened his mouth to ask how he knew, but Abberley forestalled him.
"I can feel the damp and smell the water."
Hardly had he spoken when they came out of the narrow lane, and the coachman reined in his team on the edge of a stone wharf. Tom looked out. The surface of the river was steaming with mist so dense that he could not see the far bank. The light was going fast now, and with the darkness came a sense of icy foreboding.
"This is not the landing," Tom challenged the driver. "Follow the path down that way," the man pointed with his whip. "'Tis no more than 200 paces from here."
"Drive us there if it's so close," Tom's suspicions were now fully aroused.
"The coach is too wide for the path, and it is a long way round by the road. It will take you but a minute on foot."
Abberley touched Tom's arm and said softly, "Do as he says. If this is a trap, we are better able to defend ourselves in the open."
They clambered down onto the muddy verge, and the coachman smirked at them.
"A proper gentleman would have a sixpence for my trouble." "I am no gentleman, and you have taken no trouble," Tom replied. "Next time, listen to your orders and bring us on the right road."
The driver cracked his whip angrily, and the carriage rumbled away. They watched the sidelights disappear back up the lane, and Tom took a deep breath. The river stench was strong.
damp and clammy cold, thick with the raw sewage that drained directly into its waters. The mist opened and closed like a curtain, playing tricks on the eye, but the towpath along the bank lay in front of them. On their left there was a drop of 2 fathoms or more from the edge to the water below, and a blank brick wall hedged it in on the right.
"Take the right side," Ubberly murmured. "I will be on the river verge."
Tom saw that he had shifted his scabbard onto his right hip. He had arranged it so that if he fought left-handed, which of course he could, they would not hamper each other's sword arms. "Stay to the centre of the path." They stepped onto the towpath, shoulder to shoulder, their cloaks drawn up to the chin, but ready to throw open in an instant and clear their sword arms. There was a faint glimmer of light through the mist ahead, just sufficient to illuminate the edge of the stone wharf. As they moved towards it, Tom saw that it was a single unmasked lantern. Closer still, and from the light of the lantern, he recognised through the darkening mists the open stone steps of the river landing.
"This is the right place," he said softly, so that only Ubberly would hear. "Look, there is a ferry-boat waiting, and the boatman."
The boatman was a tall, dark figure at the head of the landing. A wide-brimmed hat hid his eyes, and the collar of the cloak covered his mouth. His boat was moored from one of the iron rings set into the wharf. He had placed his lantern on the top step, and had cast his long shadow upon the stonework of the bridge behind him. Tom hesitated.
"I like it not. This has the feel of a set stage, with an actor waiting to speak his lines."
He spoke in Arabic so that no hidden listener could follow what he said.
"Why is the boatman waiting, unless he knew we were coming?" "Softly, Klebe," Ubberly warned him. "Don't let the boatman hold your eye. He is not in the danger. There will be others."
They walked on steadily towards the solitary figure, but their eyes flitted through the shadows that crowded in upon them. Suddenly another figure detached itself from the darkness and stepped into their path just beyond reach of a sword blade. The figure lifted the cowl from its head and let it drop back over her shoulders, revealing a head of thick golden curls that sparkled in the dim light.
"Good night and good cheer, lovely gentlemen,"
the woman's voice was husky and enticing. But Tom saw the repellent patches of rouge on her cheeks and the thick paint on her broad mouth, which was blue as a corpse's lips in the poor light.
"For a shilling, I will give you both a sight of Heaven's Gate."
She had forced them to halt in a narrow part of the towpath, where they were cramped, and now she swung her hips and leered at Tom in a dreadful parody of lust.
"Behind," Ubberly breathed in Arabic, and Tom heard the soft slither of a footfall on the cobbles. "I will take him, but you watch the whore," Ubberly warned, before Tom could turn, "for by the sound of her, she has a fine set of balls under her skirt."
"Sixpence for the two of us, darling," Tom said, and stepped towards her, bringing her into sword reach. At that moment he heard Ubberly whirl, but did not take his eyes from the whore. Ubberly lunged smoothly at the first of the two men who were closing in on them out of the darkness from behind. It was so swift that his victim did not even raise his blade to meet the thrust. The point went in under his ribs and came out of his back at the level of his kidneys. He screamed. Ubberly used the buried blade and the strength of his left arm to swing him like a gaffed fish and hurl him into the man behind him. His sword blade slipped out of the man's belly and the assailants staggered back, clutching at each other. The wounded man still screaming, a wild, eerie sound in the night, but he was blocking his comrade's sword arm. Ubberly sent his next thrust over his shoulder, full into the face of the man behind him. Struck full in the mouth, the man dropped his weapon and covered his face with both hands. The blood squirted out between his fingers, black and thick. He staggered away and fell backwards over the edge of the wharf. There was a single splash as he hit the dark waters below and sank immediately under the surface. The other man dropped to his knees, holding his stomach, and toppled forward onto his face. Ubberly whirled to help Tom, but he was too late. The whore had drawn a sword from under the cloak, and as she sprang at Tom, the wig dropped off and revealed her cropped head and coarse masculine features. Tom was ready for him, and jumped forward to meet his charge. The assassin was taken by surprise. He had not expected such a swift response, and he had not given himself the time to take his guard. Tom went high in the natural line, the quick kill to the base of the throat, where there is no bone to turn the stroke. His blade went through the windpipe and the great arteries of the neck to grate on the spine. He recovered and thrust again an inch lower. But this time the steel found the joint of the vertebra and went clear through.
"Hey, you are learning, Kleppy,"
Aberley hissed, as the whore dropped and lay without a twitch, his skirts pulled up over thin, hairy white legs. "But we are not finished yet, and there will be others." They came out of the dark doorways and the shadows like pariah dogs smelling offal. Tom did not bother to count them, but there were many.
"Back to back,"
Aberley ordered, and changed his sword to the stronger side. Now the narrow neck of the pathway, which had seemed to be a trap, became their stronghold. The river guarded their one flank, and the blank, windowless wall of a triple-storied house the other. Tom guessed that many more assailants were crowding in upon them from both ends of the path, but they could only attack one at a time. The next man to come at Tom was armed with an iron-tipped stave, and as he swung at Tom's head it was instantly apparent that he was an expert with this ugly weapon. Tom was thankful for all the hours that Aberley had forced him to use one in the practice yard at High Weald. He ducked under the long, heavy staff, not risking the delicate blade of the Neptune sword against such a brutal blow, but he was ready for the reverse, which he knew would be a thrust to his head. He could not give ground, for Aberley's broad back was pressed to his. The 6-foot length of the staff had kept the attacker out of reach of the blue blade until he thrust with the iron tip. The sharp iron tip came at Tom's head like an arrow from a longbow, but Tom rolled his head at the last moment and let it fly past his cheek. Then, with his left hand, he grasped the oaken shaft and let the man pull him forward within sword range. He reached forward. The blue blade sighed in the air and flickered like summer sheet lightning. Clean as a straight razor, it opened the man's throat under his jawline, and the air rushed from his open windpipe with a squeal like a piglet denied the teat. The man behind him stared at the dreadful sight as the dying man staggered in a circle. He was so entranced that he was slow to meet Tom's next lunge. Tom went high again for the base of the throat, but at the last moment his victim jerked aside and the point went in through his shoulder. The weapon he carried fell from his hand and clattered on the cobbles. He clutched his wound and shouted, "In the name of God, I am killed!" turned and blundered into the men coming up behind him. They formed a dark, struggling bunch of humanity, so closely packed that it was difficult for Tom to pick out a clear target. He stabbed 3 times fast and hard into the pack, and with each stroke there was another agonized screech. One staggered backwards and toppled over the edge of the path, arms swinging wildly as he fell from sight and hit the water in a flash of spray. The others scrambled back, holding their injuries, their faces dirty grey in the dull light. Tom heard sounds behind him, somebody moaning hollowly and another sobbing with agony. A third person was flopping and kicking on the ground like a horse down with a broken leg. Tom dared not take his eyes off the men who still confronted him, but he must know that Aberley still covered his back.
"Aberley, are you hit?"
he asked quietly. At once there was a deep voice close behind him filled with scorn.
"These are apes, not warriors. They defile my blade with their blood."
"Be not so fastidious, I beg you, old friend. How many more are there?"
"Many. But methinks they have lost stomach for the fare we are serving."
A knot of men was hovering in front of Aberley, just out of sword play. He saw their first backward paces, and suddenly he threw back his head and let forth such a cry that even Tom was startled. Despite himself, he turned his head to look back. Aberley's mouth was a great red cavern, and the tattooed features were convulsed in a mask of animal ferocity. The cry he gave was the bellow of a great bull ape, a sound that shocked the ears and stunned the senses. The men before him were racing away into the darkness, while the echoes rang across the dark river. The same panic seized those facing Tom. They whirled away and ran. 2 were limping and weaving with their wounds, but they straggled away up a side street, and the sounds of their running feet dwindled into the silence of the encroaching mist.
"I think you will have summoned the watch,"
Tom stooped and wiped his blade on the skirts of the dead whore. "They'll be on us in a minute."
"Then let us go,"
Ubberly agreed, in a voice that seemed mild and soothing after the terrible cry that had preceded it. They stepped over the crumpled bodies and ran towards the head of the steps. Ubberly raced down to where the ferryboat was moored, but Tom turned aside and went to the boatman.
"A gold guinea for your hire,"
Tom promised as he ran to meet him. He was less than 10 paces from him when the boatman threw open the folds of his cloak and raised the pistol he had concealed beneath it. Tom saw that it had twin barrels arranged side by side, and that the muzzles were like a pair of black eyeless sockets. As he stared into those blank eyes of death, the passage of the seconds seemed to freeze. Everything took on an unreal dreamlike quality. Although his eyesight seemed sharpened and every sense was heightened, yet his movements were slowed, as though he were wading through clinging mud. He saw that both hammers of the pistol were at full cock. From under the brim of the wide hat, a single dark eye glittered over the barrels at Tom, and a pale forefinger was hooked through the trigger guard, tightening inexorably. Tom watched the hammer on the left barrel drop. The puff and flash of the priming as the flint struck the steel. He tried to hurl himself aside, but his limbs obeyed only lazily. The boatman's pistol hand was thrown head high, and the weapon fired with a shattering blast. A cloud of blue gun smoke filled the air between them. At the same instant, Tom was struck a heavy blow in the body that threw him backwards. He went down heavily and lay on his back on the stones.
"I am hit," he thought with surprise, as he sprawled on the top step. He felt the numb heaviness in his chest. He knew what that presaged. "Perhaps I am killed," was his next thought, and it made him angry. He glared up at the man who had shot him. He still had the Neptune sword in his right hand, as he saw the pistol coming down like a fatal basilisk, levelling its terrible blank gaze upon him. "If I am killed, then I can no longer move my sword arm," the thought fumed in his brain, forcing him to pour every ounce of his strength and determination into his right arm. To his astonishment, the arm had lost none of its force. It whipped forward, and the sword flashed from his fingers, thrown like a javelin. He watched its flight, point first, unwavering and true, the lantern light sending golden sparks from the precious inlaid metal as it flew. Standing over him, the boatman's cloak had opened to expose his chest. He wore only a black silk shirt beneath it, laced at the throat. Before the second barrel of the pistol fired, the steel pierced the soft material under the raised pistol arm, and Tom watched its full glistening length disappear magically into the man's torso. The boatman stood rigid, locked in a mortal spasm, his heart cloven by the blade. Then he swayed backwards, and his long legs, booted in polished black leather, gave way under him. He fell backwards, lay and writhed against the agony of the blade. Then swiftly his movement stilled. Tom lifted himself on one elbow and saw Ubberly come hounding up the steps. "Klebe, where are you struck?"
"I know not. I feel nothing."
Ubberly pulled aside the folds of his cloak, then ripped open the cloth of his shirt. He groped the hard young flesh beneath, and Tom exclaimed,
"By God, gently! If I am not dead already, you will soon see to it."
Ubberly seized the lantern, which still burned on the top step, and opened the shutter fully. He shone the beam onto Tom's naked chest. There was blood, much blood.
"Low in the right side," he muttered. "Not the heart, but perhaps the lungs."
He shone the light into Tom's eyes and watched the pupils contract.
"Good. Now cough for me."
Tom did what he ordered, and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"No blood," he said as he studied his unsullied palm. "Thank all your gods and mine, Klebe,"
Ubberly grunted as he pushed Tom back.
"This will hurt," he promised. "Shout if you will, but I must gauge the track of the ball."
He found the opening of the wound, and before Tom could brace himself, slipped one long, thick finger full length into it. Tom arched his back and screamed like a virgin being rudely deflowered.
"It has struck a rib and glanced aside,"
Ubberly pulled his bloody finger out. It has not entered the cavity of your chest." He ran his hand, slippery with warm blood, around the side of Tom's chest under his arm, and felt the lump of the ball near his shoulder blade. "It has run between the bone and the skin. We will cut for it later." Then he lifted his great tattooed head as a shout echoed from the mouth of the dark lane that led down to the landing. It had the tone of harsh authority. "Stand and yield, villains, in the name of the king!"
"They watch," Abelie said. "They must not take us here surrounded by dead men." He hauled Tom to his feet. "Come, I will help you to the boat."
"Unhand me," Tom snapped at him, shrugging himself free. "I have lost my sword." Doubled over to favour his wounded side, Tom hobbled to where the boatman lay on his back. He placed his boot on the dead man's chest and pulled free the long, shining blade. He was about to turn away and go down the steps, but, on an impulse, he used the point of the blade to flick the wide-brimmed hat off the corpse's head. He stared at the dark, handsome face, surrounded by the garland of Nubian black hair that shone in the lamplight. The mouth was slack, no longer cruel, and the eyes stared into the night sky, blank and unseeing.
"Billy," Tom whispered.
He stared in horror at the face of his dead brother, and for the first time his legs went weak under him.
"Billy, I have murdered you."
"There was no murder." Abelie's great arm closed around his shoulders. "But if the watch take us here, there might well be." He swept Tom half of his feet and down the steps. Then he tumbled him into the ferry boat and leapt in beside him. With a slash of his sword, he severed the painter that secured them to the iron mooring ring in the stone wharf and seized the oars. The boat leapt forward with the strength of his stroke.
"Stop! Surrender yourselves!"
a hoarse voice shouted from the shore. In the mist there was the sound of running footsteps and the voices of more men.
"Stop, or I will fire upon you. This is the king's watchman."
Abelie pulled with both oars, grunting with the effort, and the mist banks closed around them. The dark stones of the wharf disappeared in the swirling silver clouds. Then there was the heavy detonation of a blunderbuss, and the hum as a swarm of lead shot cut through the mist. It fell like hail on the surface of the river around them, and a few pellets struck the woodwork of the boat. Tom crouched on the floorboards, hugging his injured side. Abelie heaved on the oars, sending them further out onto the broad waters. The shouts of the watch faded swiftly behind them, and Abelie stopped rowing.
"Please, do not piss on me. Keep that black python locked in your breeches," Tom pleaded in mock terror of Abelie's infamous treatment for all wounds.
Abelie grinned as he tore a strip of cloth from his undershirt. "You do not deserve such pleasures. What stupidity to walk up to an enemy offering him money!" Abelie altered his tone to mimic Tom.
"A gold guinea for your hire!"
"Ha, ha, ha!" he chuckled. He surely gave you your guinea's worth."
Abelie folded the piece of cloth into a pad and placed it over the bullet wound.
"Hold that there," he told Tom. "Press hard to staunch the bleeding." Then he seized the oars again. "The tide is with us. We will be at Eel Pie before midnight."
They were silent for an hour, rowing on quietly in the mist banks. Abelie found his way along the dark, hidden river as though it were broad day. Tom spoke at last.
"He was my brother, Abelie. He was also your enemy to the death. I swore to my father on his deathbed. You spared him once. All oaths to your father were discharged. I will have to answer for his death at Judgment Day. That is long hence." Abelie spoke in rhythm with the swinging oars. "Let it wait until then, and I will bear witness for you if your God will listen to the testimony of a heathen. How is your wound?" "The bleeding is staunched, but it hurts." "That is good. When a wound does not hurt, you are dead."
They were silent again until Tom heard the chimes of a church clock on the riverbank strike 8. He roused himself and winced at the pain of the wound.
"Nicholas Childs must have sent word to Billy where to find us," he said softly. "In the middle of our discussion, he suddenly left the room. He was gone for a long time. Time enough to send word to him."
Of course, he sent us out of our way in the carriage to afford your brother time to welcome us with his friends at their landing,
Aberley agreed.
Childs will point to us as the murderers. The magistrates will send their bailiffs to take us. Childs will have many witnesses against us. The watchman on the landing probably saw our faces. We will end up on the gallows tree if they lay their hands upon us.
This was so obviously the truth that Aberley made no comment.
Childs wanted the swallow. That is why he warned Billy where to find us. I thought the swine had resigned himself to our bargain. But he wanted it all from me, the cargo and the ship.
He is fat and greedy, Aberley agreed.
Childs knows where to send them. I told him the swallow was moored at Eel Pie.
You are not to blame. You could not see the harm in it.
Tom moved restlessly, trying to ease the pain of the stiffening wound.
Billy was a peer of the realm, an important man with powerful friends.
They will be like bulldogs. They will not let us go.
Aberley grunted, but never interrupted the rhythm of the oars.
We must sail tonight, Tom said firmly. We dare not wait until morning.
At last you have seen what was clear all along,
Aberley applauded wryly. Tom settled back against the thwart.
Now that the decision was made, he could rest easier. He dozed intermittently, but the pain kept waking him. An hour before midnight he was roused by the change in the stroke of the oars, and he looked up to see the outline of the Swallow's sleek and lovely hull appearing out of the mist just ahead. There was a riding light at her masthead, and the dark figure of the anchor watch rose from behind her gunwale and challenged them sharply.
"Who goes there?"
"Swallow!" Tom shouted the traditional reply when the ship's captain was returning, and there was an immediate stir and bustle aboard the sloop. As soon as they came alongside, many hands were ready to lift Tom on board.
"We must send for a surgeon," Ned Tyler said as soon as he saw the blood and learned the cause and extent of Tom's injury.
"No, the watch is after us," Tom stopped him. "We must sail within the hour. The tide has turned already. We must run downriver on the ebb."
"The work below decks is not complete," Ned warned him.
"I know that," Tom answered. "We will find a safe port on the south coast to finish it. We cannot use Plymouth. It is too close to home. That is the first place they will look for us. Dr. Reynolds lives at Cowes on the Isle of Wight. It is off the mainland. The bailiffs will not immediately look for us there. We can send word to the men we need to join us and finish fitting out before we sail for Good Hope." He struggled to his feet. "Where is Luke Jarvis?"
"Ashore with his wife and brats," Ned replied.
"Send for him." Luke came, still muzzy with sleep. Swiftly, Tom explained what had happened, how he had lost the cargo to Childs, and the desperate need to fly downriver at once.
"I know that I owe you the share of the Swallow and her cargo, as I promised, but I cannot pay you now. I will give you my note on the debt. I may never be able to return to England, but I will send the monies to you when I have them."
"No." Luke had woken up fully during Tom's rapid recounting of the facts. "I will not trust you for such a large sum." His voice was harsh. Tom stared at him, at a loss for words. But Luke's face split suddenly into a wolfish grin.
"I must come along with you to protect my debt."
"You don't understand," Tom said roughly. "I am going to Africa."
"I've always wanted to taste one of them coconuts," Luke said. "It will take me a minute to fetch my ditty bag, Captain. Don't slip your moorings before I return."
Tom refused to go below to the half-finished cabin, so Aberley placed a mattress on the open deck for him with a tarpaulin rigged over it to keep off the mist. Within 10 minutes, Ned had come to him.
"All shipshape and ready for sea, Captain," he reported.
"Where is Luke Jarvis?" Tom demanded.
"He should be back at any minute," Ned started, but broke off as a scream tore through the night, the cry of a woman in terrible distress.
They started in alarm and reached for their weapons just as two dark figures came running down the wooden jetty towards the Swallow.
"Oh, 'tis only Luke," Alf Wilson said with relief. "And is missus after him? We'd best get under way. She could make us all suffer."
"Cast off!" Luke yelled.
when he was only halfway down the jetty. "The she-devil is after me!" They threw off the lines and ran to the halyards. The Swallow drew away from the jetty. Luke raced the last few yards with his wife gaining on him, screeching with rage and swinging at him with a long staff. Luke leapt across the space between dock and ship.
"Luke Jarvis, you come back! You will not leave me here with the brood of bastards you got out of my belly and no food or coin to feed or clothe us. You will not go running off to Africa to rat on them black savage oars."
"Farewell, my bonny dove." Jarvis scrambled to his feet, bold now that 20 feet of water separated them. He blew her a kiss. "I will see you again in 3 years, or maybe four, or perhaps more."
"What will become of me and my innocent babes?" she whined as her mood changed. "Have you not a morsel of pity?"
She burst out into pitiful wails.
"Sell the Raven," Luke shouted back. "She'll fetch enough to keep you and your litter for 20 years. "I'll not wait for you to come back, Luke Jarvis." Her tone changed again. "There's many a good man'll be pleased to take your place in my bed." "Brave men, all of them," Luke waved his cap over his head. "They deserve you more than I do, my little geranium."
They lay up in the River Medina, half a mile upwater from Cowes. Tom had ordered Ned to have the sloop's French name painted over, but they did not replace it with her new name. She did not stand out among the other small craft in the anchorage. All the crew were enjoined to silence and warned not to speak to anyone ashore about her origins, her business, or her final destination. Dr. Reynolds came out to the ship immediately. He received Tom's message. He cut for the ball, with Tom lying on a grating in his tiny new cabin. Aberley held his arms, and Alf Wilson his legs. Reynolds found the soft lead ball on the first incision and popped it out of the swollen, inflamed flesh, like the stone of a prune. There was a bright smear on the metal where it had struck Tom's rib. Then, while Tom writhed and sweated on the grating, he probed the channel the ball had cut along his ribcage. "Ah, there they are. All the wadding and the piece of your shirt had carried in with it." Proudly the surgeon displayed these reeking trophies, holding them up in the forceps to show Tom, who lay in a sweat of agony, champing on the wooden wedge between his teeth. "I think it'll heal cleanly now," Reynolds sniffed the pus and detritus from the wound. "Sweet as a good Devon cider. The corruption has not yet taken a strong hold in your blood. However, I will leave a quill in the wound to help it drain thoroughly. I will return in 3 days to remove it." When Reynolds removed the quill, he proclaimed the operation to have been a masterpiece of the surgeon's art. Then he drank a quart jug of the rough cider Tom offered him. Under its subtle influence, he agreed, without protest or demur, to accept the post of ship surgeon that Tom pressed upon him. "This last year I have near died of boredom. Never a decent musket ball wound, nor sword cut to lighten my days. Nothing but running noses and trickling bums," he confided over the second jug of cider as they sat on the open deck beside the mainmast. "I have thought often of those balmy days on the Fever Coast." There was a burst of heavy hammering from below, and minutes later the master carpenter stuck his head out of the hatch. "The work's all done, Cap'n. You're ready to sail whenever you've a mind." Tom had hired a gang of 3 local carpenters to help complete the refitting of the Swallow. They had worked in shifts, all day and by lantern light late into the night, to meet Tom's demands. He paid them off for the excellent work they had done and bade them farewell. In the meantime, he had sent Alf Wilson and Ned Tyler by ferry across the Solent to find the best of the men they had already contracted to the voyage. They were scattered down the coast in the ports and fishing villages between Plymouth and Portsmouth, waiting for Tom to summon them. Tom and Master Walsh went with them as far as Southampton. They visited the chandlers and merchants to purchase the stores and trade goods they needed to complete fitting out the Swallow and provision her for an extended trading voyage. From the last voyage with his father, Tom knew what goods were most in demand among the black African tribes. He ordered and paid for almost 2 tons of Merikani cotton cloth, 2,000 axe heads, 5 tons of copper wire, 500 hand mirrors, 1 ton of Venetian glass beads, 20 pounds of needles, 100 cheap muskets with powder flasks and short bags, and 1 ton of assorted trinkets and gewgaws.
Most of these goods were safely delivered across the Solent and stored on board within the week. Tom left Master Walsh in Southampton to see to the purchase of the last of the trade goods and went back to the ship. He fretted throughout the last few days as his crew began to come in across the Solent in singles and small groups, carrying their bags slung over their shoulders. He greeted each by name as they came aboard and had them place their marks on the watchbill. They were the best of all those who had sailed on the Seraph and the other ships of the squadron. Tom was delighted and relieved to have them on board. He paid each his silver shilling of joining money and sent them below to claim the pegs on which to hang their hammocks. Master Walsh arrived back from their buying expedition aboard the barge he had hired to bring the last consignment of trade goods and ship stores down Southampton Water and across the Solent to where the Swallow was anchored in the Medina. When these goods were loaded, the Swallow's holds were filled, and she lay low in the water. However, Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson had not yet returned, and they were forced to wait for them. There was not an hour that passed when Tom did not look to the shore and worry about the threat of the bailiffs that hung over him. He was certain that the officers of the law were already scouring all the ports along the south coast. He guessed they had started at Plymouth and were spreading out from there, searching for the sloop. It was only a matter of time before they reached the Isle of Wight and began to make the inquiries that would lead them to where the Swallow lay. There was another worry. The autumn was far advanced, and soon winter would cast her stormy net across the seaways to the south and lock them in. However, these days of grace gave his wound time to heal. By now he was vigorous and strong again, eager to be on his way. At night in his tiny cabin he was haunted by the murder of his brother, and he brooded on his guilt. In his Bible, with its worn leather cover, he read and reread the story of Cain and Abel, and found little there to comfort him. Then, at the end of 2 weeks, Alf Wilson and Ned Tyler returned. The two were surprised by the warmth and enthusiasm of his welcome. "Jeremy Compton has changed his mind, and we could not find Will Barnes or John Burdham," Ned was apologetic. "No harm done, Ned," Tom assured him expansively, and they went over the watchbill together, assigning each man to his station. Ned was the first mate. Alf, Luke and Aberley, the other officers, were the crew of 27 tried and tested old salts to make up the full complement. "There is only one more load of trade goods to arrive, 200 weight of red and green Venetian glass beads," Tom told his officers. "With luck, they'll come in tomorrow. We'll sail with the next tide after they are stowed." They settled in for what was to be their last night before sailing. As the sun set behind a thick mattress of grey cloud, a deputation led by Luke Jarvis came to Tom, where he sat brooding in the bows, staring across the water at the lamplights in the village, taking his leave of England for ever, saddened by the looming exile into which he was condemned for the rest of his life, and yet elated at the prospect of being able at last to begin the search for Dorian and his return to that mysterious beckoning land so far to the south. "There is some of the lads that would take a last pot of ale in the tavern and kiss a pretty Christian girl once more before we sail on the morrow. Will you give them permission to go ashore for an hour, Captain?" Luke asked respectfully. Tom thought about it for a minute. It was not wise to allow men ashore, for when they had liquor in them, even the best seamen were wild and untrustworthy. "They will not taste a good English ale these next 3 years," Luke prodded him delicately. He was right, Tom thought. It would be hard on them if he refused. He could see the lighted windows of the tavern across the water. They would be almost within hail. There could be little harm in it. "Will you go with them, Mr. Jarvis, and see to it that it is an hour and no more?" "Why do you not come across with us your good self, Captain? They will mind their manners and come away prompt and sober if they are under your eye." "It would be better than sitting here worrying about things that might never happen, Klebby," Aberley said softly, from where he sat beside the mast. "The lads will take it well, to have you buy them a jug and drink with them to the success of our voyage." Tom left Ned in command of the sloop, and with him a few who would rather be in their hammock than in their cups. The rest rowed ashore in one of the longboats. The taproom of the tavern was noisy and crowded with lobstermen and fishermen and the crews of the Royal Navy men-of-war. The air was thick and blue with tobacco smoke. Tom ordered jugs of ale for his lads, and he and Abberley retired to a corner where they could watch the room and the door. Jim Smiley and one or two of the others started a boisterous conversation with a trio of women in the far corner, and within minutes they slipped away in couples. Although it had started raining lightly, they disappeared into the night.
"They will not be far off," Abberley quieted Tom's misgivings. "I told them to stay within call."
Tom had not lowered the contents of his jug an inch from the rim when two strange men came in through the front door and stood on the threshold, beating the raindrops off their cocked hats and the shoulders of their cloaks.
"I do not like the looks of these," said Tom uneasily, and set aside his jug.
They were both big, brawny fellows with grim, stolid faces.
"They have not come here to revel and carouse."
"Stay here," Abberley said, and rose to his feet. "I will find out more about their business."
He made his way casually through the crowd of drinkers, and followed the pair as they pushed through the crowd to where the goodwife and two wenches were filling ale jugs from the spigot of a 20-gallon keg.
"Good morrow, mistress," the elder of the strange pair greeted the wife. "I would like a word."
"Words are cheap."
She looked up and brushed the hair from her eyes.
"Let's see your halfpence for a pot, and you can talk as much as you like."
The man slapped a coin on the table, and Abberley drifted closer so that he could listen to every word while remaining unobtrusive.
"I'm looking for a ship," said the big man.
"Then you have come to the right place. There are ships aplenty hereabouts. Yonder is Spithead, and the whole bloody navy. Take your pick."
"The ship I seek is a little sloop."
The man grinned at her ingratiatingly, but his eyes were cold and hard.
"A pretty little ship with the name of the Hirondelle."
His pronunciation of the French name was murderous.
"Or perhaps the Swallow."
Abberley did not wait for the goodwife's reply, but turned away and strode towards where most of the crew of the sloop were standing in a group, laughing and swigging from their pots. Tom was watching him across the smoky room, and Abberley jerked his head in an unmistakable summons. Tom came to his feet and went among the crowd, but not so obviously as to draw attention, singling out his men, tapping each on the shoulder and giving them a quiet word. Abberley was doing the same, and shepherding the seamen out into the drizzling rain.
"What is it?" Luke demanded.
"Bailiffs are drawing our cover," Abberley told him. "Where are John Smiley and his mates?"
"Unloading their cargo into some pretty little pink port, like as not," Luke said.
"Well, whistle them up," Tom ordered. "We will not wait on the tide."
Luke lifted the whalebone whistle that hung from a lanyard around his neck and blew two sharp blasts. Almost immediately, John Smiley came running out of the shadows at the rear of the tavern. The others stumbled after him, hauling up their breeches and smoothing down their petticoats.
"Back to the boat, lads," Tom told them, "or get left behind."
It was less than 100 paces to the jetty where the longboat was tied up, but they had covered only half that distance when a stentorian bellow followed them.
"Thomas Courtney, stand in the name of the law."
Tom glanced over his shoulder and saw the two big men burst out through the tavern doorway and come pelting after them.
"I have a warrant signed by the Chief Justice of England. You are charged with the bloody murder of Lord Courtney."
The challenge spurred Tom on.
"Run for it, lads!"
They reached the head of the stone steps, well ahead of the bailiffs. But there they ran into a bottleneck on the narrow stairway, and the two big men gained on them rapidly. Each had drawn a sword from under his cloak, and their heavy boots pounded over the cobbles.
"Stop, in the name of the law!"
"I will hold them off,"
Abberley rumbled and turned to face them.
"Go into the boat."
Instead, Tom turned with him and they stood at the head of the stairs, shoulder to shoulder.
"Your wound. You cannot wield a sword yet. Will you never listen to me?"
Abberley demanded. "Only when you make sense." Tom changed the Neptune sword into his left hand as the pain of his unhealed wound stabbed him in the side.
"I will kill you if you force me to it," he shouted at the approaching pair, in such a tone as to bring them up short. They hesitated just out of swordplay. "We are officers of the law. Touch one of us at your peril." They were disconcerted by the odd pair who confronted them, the fresh-faced youth with the bent nose and the scarified black giant. "And I am a murderer with bloody hands. One more death means little to me," Tom laughed ghoulishly. "This savage here eats men raw. He likes their heads best. He sucks the flesh off the bones." Abberley whipped the hat off his great bald head and scowled at them, contorting his tattooed face into a grotesque mask. The bailiff stepped back involuntarily. Behind his back, Tom heard the last of his men tumble into the longboat and the oars creaking in the rowlocks. "Come on board, Captain," Luke Jarvis yelled. "Shove off," Tom yelled at Luke and leapt forward to meet the two bailiffs. "On guard! Defend yourselves!" He thrust at the man in front of him, driving him back, flashing the blade inches from his eyes, snagging and splitting the fabric of his coat with the point, but always careful not to wound him. The bailiffs had only to touch blades to realize that they were outclassed, and they retreated before the combined attack. Luke Jarvis shouted again. Tom glanced swiftly over his shoulder. The longboat hovered just off the wharf, with the rowers resting on their oars. "Time to go," he said to Abberley in Arabic, and made two more rapid lunges at the bailiff's faces that sent them stumbling backwards in panic. Then he and Abberley whirled and ran to the edge of the wharf. They leapt together far out and dropped into the water with their cloaks ballooning behind them. As soon as they surfaced, the longboat shot in to pick them up. Tom held the Neptune sword in his right hand and side-paddled with the other arm to meet the boat. The crew lifted him and Abberley out of the water and turned immediately, pulling mightily for where the Swallow lay. Once they were all safely aboard, it took only minutes to recover the longboat and rope it down on the foredeck, while the other watch were on the windlass, hoisting the anchor from the muddy bottom. The bailiffs must have commandeered their skiff. They were halfway across from the wharf when the Swallow hoisted her mainsail and heeled to the night wind. As they bore away down the narrow inlet towards the open water of the Solent, they passed the small boat close. One of the bailiffs stood up in the stern and pointed his drawn sword at Tom as he stood beside the Swallow's helm. "You can never escape," he shouted across the gap between the two craft. "You have blood on your hands, and we will smell you out no matter where you go on the face of this earth." Tom made no reply, but looked dead ahead. They left the small boat bobbing in their wake. The wind treated them like a lover. It came from the north, the harbinger of winter, cold and swift, but not so strong as to force them to put a reef in the main. Within a week they had cleared Ushant. Then the north wind whisked them across Biscay, that notorious breeder of gales and turbulent seas, and south past the Canaries and out into the doldrums. Here they expected it to falter, become fluky and erratic, but it blew sweet and constant. One day, after the noon sun shot, Tom marked their position on the line of the equator 1,000 nautical miles west of the massive bulge of the African continent. "New course is south by east, Mr. Tyler, full and by." He marked it on the traverse board. Ned Tyler touched his forehead. "Full and by it is, Captain." Tom looked up at the Swallow's mainsail. It was swollen tight and white as an 8 months pregnant belly. Then he looked over the stern. The wake was slick and straight across the wind-ruffled Atlantic swells. "With this wind we will raise the Cape in less than 60 days, and 30 days later we will drop our hook in Zanzibar Roads." He had left all his doubts and misgivings far under the northern horizon, and now he felt strong and invulnerable. Abd Muhammad al-Malik's dhow was in disarray. The fallen boom that had almost killed the prince had left the ship drifting helplessly, bows to the wind, her decks smothered under the heavy woven matting sail, and her rigging in a shambles. Blocks were swinging and banging against the mast and hull in the strong gusts of the monsoon, and her rigging was whipping and snapping, threatening to flog itself and the ship into further ruin. The first thing that had to be done to bring order out of this destruction was to capture the end of the main halyard.
This heavy rope was flying from the top of the mast. Rove through the eye of the main block at the masthead, it could not be pulled back from the deck. This would merely compound the problem of hoisting the great lateen sail and getting the ship sailing again. Someone would have to climb the mast. Unlike a square-rigged ship, no shroud secured it, and there was no other easy form of access to the masthead. With her mainsail down, the dhow was rolling wildly in the heavy swells. The captain was trying to keep her bows into the sea with the tiller as she made sternway, but every now and then a heavier sea would catch her broadside and roll her almost clean over. The mast was like a gigantic pendulum as it whipped from side to side, aggravating these violent movements. The ship was in dire danger. The captain could not leave the tiller, but he screeched orders at his men as they huddled as far from him as the deck would allow, all trying to avoid his eye. They knew full well what needed to be done, but not one was willing to attempt the climb to the masthead. Dorian watched all this pandemonium with excited fascination. There had never been anything so entertaining on the deck of the Seraph, not all the screaming and gesticulation.
"Ahmed, son of the great sow,"
Faoud, the captain, singled out another victim and pointed with a shaking finger to the top of the mast.
"I will wrap your corpse in a pigskin before I throw you overboard if you do not obey me."
The man turned away his head and stared out to sea, as if he had been smitten deaf. Dorian measured the climb with an experienced eye and wondered what they were all so afraid of. He had danced a hornpipe with Tom on the main yard of the Seraph, one hand on his hip, the other touching the top of his head while the ship ran with the Cape Rollers under her stern and the southeaster blew half a gale. This mast was only a third the height of the Seraph's main. He could almost hear Tom's voice mocking him.
"Come on, Dorry, show them what you can do. I'll give you guts."
No one was looking at him. They'd all forgotten him in the desperate exigency of the moment. Even the prince had forsaken his customary aplomb and was clinging to one of the stays on the foredeck, staring up at the swaying masthead. Dorian slipped off the long robe and threw it down on the deck. The skirts would tangle his legs. Naked as a newborn, he ran to the foot of the mast and shot up it like a monkey pursued by a leopard. The prince recovered his poise and shouted,
"Stop that child! He will kill himself!"
Dorian was well out of reach of the frantic hands trying to carry out the royal command. His agility and head for heights had been developed and refined in the rigging of the Seraph, and by those standards it was an easy climb. He used the roll of the hull and the swing of the mast to propel himself upwards, gripping alternately with knees and hands. He reached the top of the mast and glanced down. He saw their terrified faces turned up towards him, and could not resist the temptation to show off a little more. He wrapped both legs around the mainstay and let go with one hand. He placed his thumb on the tip of his nose and wiggled his fingers down at the deck in a derisive gesture. Even though the crew had never seen this gesture before, the meaning was unmistakable. Dorian's naked body gleamed white as an oyster shell in the sunlight, and his bare bottom was round and pink. He waggled it at them to emphasize the insult. A moan of dread and horror went up from the watchers below as he climbed higher. They knew that the prince's wrath would be dreadful if any harm came to the boy, and that it would fall squarely upon their heads. They moaned again as Dorian reached out and gripped the flapping halyard.
"Belay the end!" he shouted down at the deck, using maritime English.
But his order was clear to the captain, who, having divined his meaning, then translated it into Arabic. The three men ran to grab the standing end of the heavy line. As soon as they had it ready to break his fall, Dorian took two turns of the unravelled, worn sail end around his waist, and then ran it back between his legs.
"Break my fall!"
he yelled again. He waited for the right moment in the swing of the mast, then released his grip and kicked himself clear. The halyard squealed through the block as he dropped. The men on the standing end of the line let it run through their leathery palms, breaking his fall as Dorian came down. He was swooping far out over the water at each travel of the dhow's roll, and he whooped with the exhilaration of each swing through the air. The men on the other end of the halyard judged his descent with sailor's skill and allowed him to drop down the last few fathoms of the rope so lightly that his bare feet made no sound as they touched the deck. There was a rush to ensure he was safe, and to secure the tail end of the halyard, which was wrapped around his waist. As soon as a fresh rope was rove through the block at the masthead, and the boom was hoisted once more, the dhow came on the wind, transformed by the press of the lateen sail from a helpless rolling hulk into a thing of the sea, agile and swift. The prince placed one hand on Dorian's shoulder and looked around the faces of his retinue. By his quickness of thought and action, this child has saved my life and that of the ship, he announced. Is there one of you who still doubts that this is the red-crowned orphan of the prophecy? He laid his hand on Dorian's shining curls and looked each of his courtiers in the eyes. Not one could hold his gaze. It was the mullah who spoke out first. It is the miracle of St. Taimtaim, he cried. I declare the holy word. This is the child of the prophecy. It is the prophecy, they chorused. Praise God's name. With his hand still on Dorian's head, the prince said clearly, Let all men know that I take this child as my adopted son. Henceforth he shall be known as Al-Ahammara ibn al-Malik, the Red One, son of al-Malik. The mullah smiled slyly at his master's cunning. By making the child his own son, he had neatly validated the prophecy of the saint. But other conditions had to be fulfilled before the prince could reap the rewards the old saint had promised. No doubt in due season these also could be met. It is the will of God, cried the mullah. The others intoned in chorus, God is great. Even without the prince's commendation, over the weeks they spent at sea, Dorian had earned himself a place in the affections of every member of the crew. It was clear to all of them that the boy was a bird of good omen, and each one secretly hoped that some of the promise of the prophecy might rub off on him. As Dorian moved about the deck, even the most hardened villainous sailors smiled and bantered with him, or touched his red head for luck. The ship's cook made special sweetmeats and sugared delights for him, while the rest of the crew vied with each other for his attention, and pressed small gifts on him. One even took the charm he wore on a thong around his neck and placed it over Dorian's head. May this shield you, he said, and made the sign against the evil eye. Little monkey with the heart of a lion, Fawud, the captain, named him fondly, after evening prayers called Dorian to sit with him at the helm. He pointed out the navigational stars as they rose out of the sea, recited the names of the constellations, and told Dorian the legends behind each one. These Arabs were men of the deserts and the ocean. They lived their entire lives under the panoply of heaven, and the stars were always overhead. They had studied them over the centuries, and now the captain was sharing some of this knowledge with Dorian. It was a rare gift he was offering the child. Dorian listened in fascination, his upturned face shining in the light of the heavens. Then, in his turn, he gave the captain the English names of the heavenly bodies, which he had learned from Aberley and Big Daniel. The other crewmen gathered round them and listened to the fables of the Seven Sisters, of Orion the Hunter and of the Scorpion, as Dorian related them in his sweet high voice. They loved the stars, and they loved a good story. Now that he had a free run of the ship, there was so much to occupy him that Dorian had little time to feel lonely or sorry for himself. He would spend half the morning hanging over the dhow's side, watching a pod of long-nosed dolphins frolicking in the bow wave, their wide tails pumping and their knowing eyes looking up at him as they dodged back and forth under the bows. Suddenly one of the creatures would spring from the dazzling blue water as high as where Dorian stood and grin at him with its wide mouth. Dorian waved at it and burst into delighted peals of laughter. The Arab seamen closest to him would pause in their labours and smile in sympathy. Whenever he became too involved in conversation with them, though, Fawud would call to him possessively, "Come here, little monkey with the lion heart, steer the ship for me." Dorian would take the tiller, and his eyes sparkled as he held the running dhow on the wind. Felt her tremble under his hands like a thoroughbred horse gathering itself for a jump. Sometimes the prince, sitting cross-legged on the silk carpet under his sun tent, would break off a discussion with his courtiers and watch the boy with a little smile on his lips. As Dorian was still a boy and had not yet felt the circumcision knife, Tahi could go unveiled in his presence. She was that lowliest creature, a divorced woman. Her husband was one of the prince's grooms. Unable to give him a son, Tahi had been discarded. Only Al-Malik's beneficence and compassion had saved her from begging in the streets and souks of Lamu. Tahi was big and plump and round all over, her skin well greased and brown. She loved her food and had a jolly laugh and an easy-going disposition. Her loyalty and devotion to the prince were the centre of her existence. Now, suddenly, Dorian was the son of her master. Like all the others on board, Tahi was smitten by his beautiful red hair, his strange pale green eyes and milky white skin. When he unleashed the full force of his sunny smile and winning charm upon her, she could not resist him. Childless herself, he assuaged all her maternal instincts, and very soon she had lost her heart to him. When the prince appointed her Dorian's official nurse, she wept with gratification. It did not take long for Dorian to discover that her bland, almost bovine features concealed a shrewd intelligence and a sharp political sense. She understood all the currents of power and influence in the prince's court, and navigated these with rare skill. She explained to him who were the great and important men in the prince's retinue, their strengths and their failings, their foibles, and how to treat each of them. She coached him in the etiquette of the court, and in how to comport himself in the presence of the prince and his followers. For Dorian, the nights were the only bad times. In the dark, memories of Tom and his father crept up on him and overwhelmed him. One night, Tahi woke to hear stifled sobs coming from where Dorian lay on his thin mattress on the far side of the little cabin they shared. An outcast herself, she understood instinctively the homesickness and loneliness of a small boy, torn from his family and all things familiar and dear, cast among strangers of a different race, religion, and way of life. She rose quietly and went to him, lying beside him on the mattress, and taking him into her warm, soft, motherly embrace. At first, Dorian tried to resist and pushed her away, but then he let himself relax and lie still in her arms. She murmured little endearments against the top of his shining head, all the love words she had bottled up inside her for the son her barren womb had denied her. After a while, the rigidity went out of Dorian's body, and he moved closer to her, cuddling his head between her great round breasts, and at last he slept. The next night he went to her mattress quite naturally, and she opened her fat arms and drew him to her. "My baby," she whispered in wonder at the depth of her emotion, "my own beautiful baby." Dorian could not remember the comfort of his own mother's arms, but there was a deep need in him. Tahi soon came to fill a great part of that void. As the dhow drew closer to her home port, Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik sat under his awning, not too deeply involved in affairs of state and business, to lack time to ponder the prophecy of the saint and to watch the boy with a veiled but keen appraisal. Al-Alama, he used the family name of his mollah, what revelations have you received regarding the child? The mullah hooded his eyes, shielding his thoughts from the penetrating perception of his master. "He is winsome, and he draws people to him as honey draws bees." "That is evident." The prince's voice had an edge to it. "But it is not what I asked of you. It seems that he has those attributes described by the holy Taim Taim," Al-Alama went on cautiously, "but it will be many years hence before we can be certain of that. In the meantime, we must guard him well and nurture those traits that are necessary to fulfil the prophecy," Al-Malik suggested. "We will do all in our power, great prince. It will be your duty to lead him in the paths of righteousness and reveal to him the wisdom of the prophet, so that he will in time come gently to the faith and submit himself to Islam. He is a child still. We cannot hope to place a man's head on such young shoulders." "Every journey begins with the first step," the prince contradicted him. "Already he speaks the sacred language of the faith better than some of my other children, and he has displayed some knowledge of religious matters. He has been tutored.
It will be your sacred duty to foster that knowledge and enlarge upon it until in time he submits to Islam. Only in that way can the prophecy be fulfilled in its entirety.
As my lord commands, Al-Alama made a sign of acquiescence, touching his lips and his heart. I will take the first step of the long journey this very day, he vowed to the prince, who nodded his appreciation.
If it please Allah.
After the midday prayers, and when the prince had retired to his cabin in the stern to be with his concubines, Al-Alama sought out the child. He was engrossed in discussion with Fa'ud. The captain was instructing him in navigation of the islands, pointing out to him the seabirds and clumps of drifting weed that indicated the run of the currents. He called these the rivers of the sea, and was explaining to Dorian how the islands and the shape of the coast affected these mighty rivers, bending and twisting them and subtly altering their shading of blue and green. Under Ned Tyler's instruction, Dorian had come to enjoy every facet of the art of navigation. Some of his most pleasant memories were of working through a sunshot with Tom, or taking a bearing on a land feature, then marking the chart and writing up the results in the ship's log, arguing and laughing with his elder brother as they did so. Now Fa'ud was teaching him the lore of these regions of the ocean, the names and habits of the seabirds and creatures, and the drifting weed. There were small birds with snowy plumage that dived and fluttered over the ship's wake. You will not find them further than 10 leagues from land. Watch the direction of their flight, and they will lead you to it, Fa'ud told him. At another time he beckoned him to the ship's rail and pointed overside. Look, little monkey, one of the monsters of the sea, but gentle as an unweaned lamb. They were passing so close to it that Dorian jumped onto the gunwale and looked down on its dappled back. He could see that it was not one of the whales they had encountered by the hundreds in the southern reaches of the Atlantic. It seemed to be a species of shark, but it was almost as long as the dhow. Unlike the tiger or the hammerhead, which he knew, this beast moved lazily and unafraid through the clear waters. Dorian could see the shoal of little pilot fish that swam just ahead of its cavernous mouth.
"Are they not afraid they will be eaten?" he cried.
The monsters eats only the tiniest creatures of all, slime and crawling things that float in the sea, smaller than rice grains. Fa'ud was enjoying the enthusiasm of his pupil. When you see one of these gentle monsters, it means that the monsoon is ready to change from the Kaskazi to the Kuzi, from the northwest to the southeast. Al-Alama interrupted the pair and led Dorian away to where they could talk in private. Dorian looked disappointed and followed him only reluctantly.
"Once you spoke thus in reply to my question," Al-Alama reminded him. "I am but a man like yourselves, but the inspiration has come to me that your God is one God. Whoever expects to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness."
"Yes, Holy One." Dorian was not particularly interested in this new topic. He would have much preferred to continue his animated discussion with Fa'ud. However, Tahi had warned him of how powerful the mullah was, and how he could protect or punish a small boy in his power.
"He is the servant of God, and a voice of the Prophet. Treat him with great respect, for all our sakes," Tahi had said.
So Dorian was attentive.
"Who taught you these things?" Al-Alama demanded.
"I had a teacher." Dorian looked suddenly, as though he was on the point of tears.
"When I was with my father, his name was Alf, and he taught me Arabic."
"So it was he who made you learn the Quran, the sacred book of the Prophet?"
"Only some verses to write and discuss. That verse from Surah 18 was one of them."